Blog Talk Radio. Hello, welcome to Pharma Talk Radio, brought to you by the Conference Forum. I'm Valerie Bowling, the Executive Director, and I'm pleased to bring you our Clinical Air series, hosted by Craig Lipsett, Head of Clinical Innovation R&D at Pfizer. I would like to thank our sponsor, Inventive Health. And please note that the opinions Craig and our guests share on this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of their employers. And with that, I would like to welcome Craig Lipsett. So, Craig, would you like to take over?
Thank you, Val. Hello and welcome aboard. This is flight number one of Clinical Air on the Pharma Talk Radio Network. My name is Craig Lipsett, and while I lead clinical innovation at Pfizer, the opinions you'll hear are my own and not necessarily those of my employer. Broadcasting today from New York City on what's turned out to be a beautiful day, and I am psyched to kick off this new platform. I have my fingers crossed that this show is going to stick and to grow. I think it's something new for everyone. We are going to have unscripted, authentic conversations with interesting people doing some amazing things. And I'm looking forward to hearing their stories and asking questions that we all care about. So I invite you to unbuckle your seatbelt and lose your baggage. And our next order of business will be to introduce my co-pilot for today. So Val gave me the opportunity to think of absolutely anyone that we could invite as a co-pilot for this first flight, and I immediately thought of Joe Kim at Shire. I know Joe from conferences and meetings because Joe does two things. He does interesting things, and he shares those things, and that can range from clever applications of mobile and recruitment and so on. So Joe, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Craig. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm flattered that you thought of me first, or at least in the top three or five.
Do you think I'm going to say that everybody else was booked, Joe?
Yeah. I can take it.
So, Joe, what do you do at Shire?
So, my official title is Director of Clinical Operations here at Shire, but I think my mandate is bigger than that. I'd like to think that I try and help our research operations do everything better, whether it's, you know, setting realistically aggressive timelines down to ensuring we get a pulse on the patient to make sure we can drive their retention in clinical research and everything in between, whether it's sourcing new technologies for workflow optimization or getting into social media and learning about patient leaders in our industry.
So you've really managed to, you know, expand that scope quite a bit from probably what somebody at Shire wrote as a rather typical job description.
Yeah, well, you know, they always say, you know, you write your own job description. As long as you can provide value along the way, it behooves any organization to let folks do what they do best, as long as it's aligned with the vision and mission of the organization. So yeah, I've had, you know, great fun, you know, helping teams with both sort of industry groundbreaking applications of e-consent down to just helping them with the brass tacks of, you know, how to understand a good keyword campaign and what to look for from conversion rates, click-through rates, you know, that sort of thing. And it's been a great both learning experience and coaching experience.
So What road led you there to Shire? I know that you were a former Merck guy at one point, right?
Yeah, so, you know, it's always about, as Steve Jobs said, connecting the dots backwards. I think it's a little presumptuous to even say, like, well, here's what I want to do in even 5 years, because it's so deterministic, and you need a lot of chutzpah to say something like that often. So what I try and do is just try and figure out, you know, what will put me in the best alternatives moving forward, kind of like a game of chess, right? Well, like, what's a nice place where I have lots of variety I can springboard off of? So prior to this, I spent some time at ePharma Solutions, which is a sort of well-known niche e-clinical technology partner here in the industry. Before that, I was at Merck, which is really where I got my start in trial optimization. However, that was my second tour of duty there. So from about 2006 to 2009, I worked with Lolo Erickson, who's now at PowerXL, developing the sort of industry's inaugural global trial optimization group. By the time I left, there was, you know, something like 30 or 40 folks focused just on trial optimization. Between my two tours of duty at Merck, I did spend some time at a CRO, both in from a clinical R&D role and as well as selling. I did a little bit of business development for about a year with MDS Pharma back when it was still MDS. I think INC had purchased it since then. My territory was the unforgivable Eastern Canadian biotechs. And I only say it's unforgivable because it was very cold up there, although I love Montreal. It's a great part of the world. But that market sort of was all wrapped up there. So it was a great learning experience actually doing some business development out there, and I learned a lot. I don't regret any step that I took along the way. And it led me to Shire, and I wouldn't be enjoying my tenure here at Shire without having done all those varied things in the past.
You know, everybody sells in one way or another, Joe, and if you embrace it, it's a good thing. You learn those skills, you learn that resilience, you learn about listening to people and making sure that, you know, you're communicating a message that resonates. I think those are key lessons for so many roles we all play today.
Yeah, definitely.
So what was in the water there at Merck? I mean, it's like some great diaspora occurred from there. Whether it's, you mentioned, you know, Lolo, who we'll have to have on a future show. There are a number of folks that seem to have been incubated in that group and now all across the industry.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I think there was – Lolo did a great job at building a really good entrepreneurial culture there inside of an organization who's really great at what it does, but historically probably hasn't been known for its sort of internal entrepreneurialism, let's call it. I still have lots of friends there. My spouse still works there at Merck, so I've ties to that company, and it's really how I got my start in the industry from a clinical research perspective. So I have to credit a lot to sort of Lolo's enthusiasm and inspiration to bring good talent on board, expose them to a lot of different things, and just give us the sort of courage to, within our organization, be entrepreneurial. And that kind of, I think, affected a lot of us, you know, allowing to do that external to that.
Great. That's great. Hey, Joe, you're always working on interesting things over there. What are you working on right now that excites you? What's top on your list?
Well, I'd like to wrap up sort of the e-consent. This is, for me, this has been the year of the e-consent and trying to encourage lots of people to try it out without getting them too overexcited to go big. I know the phrase "go big or go home," but in some cases, I think it's good just to try something out to see if you can do it, and then go big after you've tried it once. So hopefully, I can sort of wrap that up this year. Not wrap it up, but get enough of enthusiasm where people can sort of feel courageous enough to do it on their own. And I'd like to cheer them from the sidelines. The next thing I'd really like to try and really understand and engage in some meaningful way, and you see a lot of writing in the media about influencers and how to make the best use of social media. And to me, influencers take on a really large role in any industry, particularly for pharmaceuticals, because patients are self-assembling. They're getting more powerful in terms of the data they have access to, both sharing it, mobilizing it, quantifying it, creating structures around it, normalizing it, and there's a whole slew of sort of Web 2.0 communities. The best example probably is, you know, Chronology. Sean Ahrens is the co-founder there, and I talk to him regularly to see where we can sort of collaborate and use his platform, not just to, you know, find patients for research, right? That's an obvious play, but really think about a way to use influencers and these patient communities and these platforms to do what the phrase is participatory science, which is different from participatory medicine. So to me, participatory medicine is what chronology does and patients like me does already. Participatory science is taking it to the next level and pulling that engagement way upstream where you can now then involve patients in study design, let's call it. And so I'm not talking about surveys, right? That's sort of another obvious play. Like, sure, let's ask people, how many overnight stays would you rather do? You know, 3, 5, or 10? Most people will probably say 3, but you could have answered that question too. So what I'd like to do is try and figure out a way where you can create an asynchronous dialogue using technology around something like numbers of visits. So wouldn't it be great to say, here are the different numbers of stays you can pick, and then show them the trade-offs for picking one over the other, right? So maybe you can enroll less patients, or maybe a procedure will be less invasive, or maybe we can shorten the duration of a trial if patients are willing to stay or do more. So if we can have a better way to show them the trade-offs and come up with, you know, the right experimental design, that's something that's really exciting me now. And, you know, it's right now it's just conversations I'm having. There's nothing official that we're doing. But, you know, I do talk to someone like Sean and folks like patients like me. I'd love to engage for that as well.
Do you see bits and pieces of that in any other verticals? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, sites like Kayak where I have trade-offs I have to make. Maybe there's a flight at a better time, but I'm going to have to pay a premium. I have to be able to toggle those trade-offs to get to the right balance for me. Do you see other verticals that can kind of facilitate that for R&D?
Yeah, I think you know, this has been the sort of the general theme with a lot of innovation in clinical research is that these problems and models have been applied to some degree in lots of other industries. So yeah, that's one that's perfect. Another one that's maybe more sort of technical and egg-headed is, you know, these open source platforms where you have communities working on, you know, languages or other kinds of applications where they together create the next version of something, whether it's Bluetooth or something like that.
So outside of your world at Shire, is there anything, what are you seeing anyone else working on that's exciting to you? Something that you picked up at a conference or in a journal? Anyone else's work that you're eyeing right now?
Yeah, you know who I always love to see present, aside from you, is Nariman Nasir, I think, from UCSF. She always, I think I'm saying her name right. If not, I apologize. But she's doing a lot of cutting-edge things in the mobile space and the social space. So a couple years ago, I saw her present on an ePro for an HIV study. And it basically had to do with sexual behaviors of the research participants. And they tried it on paper once, and it didn't work so well. And they created a mobile app, and you know the reporting rate went through the roof, which was really cool. She also has described some of her efforts around using Facebook actually to do some of the research components or operationalize some of the research at UCSF. So I'm always excited to see her and see what she's been able to conjure up. Granted, it's not industry pharma because it's academic, but it's nice to see. The tables turned where academia is actually a little bit more advanced and riskier from that perspective.
I love it. That's great. Hey, Val, I hope you're taking copious notes for great new names for future shows. So, Joe, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on a couple of headlines that I've seen pop up in my inbox in the last few days. But let me ask you, how do you stay current with the news? What do you read first every morning?
Yeah, good question. It's there's a whole variety of things that I'll hit right from the get-go. So I subscribe to a lot of LinkedIn groups, that a lot of which are not even, you know, sort of pharma industry groups. So one might be just straight up digital technology or mobile technology. More related ones are like Health 2.0. And then also sort of Twitter feeds related to digital advertisement and mobile technology. So a lot of technology kind of feeds I'll get as well. Also coming into my inbox is, of course, the DIA news feed, the pink sheet, the gray sheet. There's a lot of stuff that comes through, faster cures. It's really hard to stay on top of it, but everyone does a pretty good job at sort of giving you the top line of each thing, and I can scan pretty quickly and figure out, okay, do I want to drill into this later? I've just started using Evernote, which I'm trying to figure out how that fits into my life versus any other sort of reminding technology, let's call it, or way to keep things on top of mind. At some point, I'll be good at triaging this stuff. Particularly if I like something, I'll definitely post it on LinkedIn or Twitter, knowing that I can always go back to it. It's hard. There's a lot. It's the fire hose of data. But it's fun.
A lot to curate with that morning cup of coffee.
Exactly.
Hey, my confession is I have Evernote open right in front of me right now.
Nice.
Nice little plug for a free app that's pretty handy. So here's one that popped up in my inbox the other day. It was a headline about a research study that was posted by Research America at the end of July. This was one looking at minority patient participation in research. It was a national poll. It says 1,800 adults of various race and ethnicity. It was actually run by Zogby and sponsored by, Research America, Clinical Trial Transformation Initiative, FNLM, ACRO, and the Clinical Research Forum. So it looks like the good news was that minority patients were actually pretty supportive of clinical trials. So that was nice. Maybe that dispels some of the myths about persistent trust issues. But it looks like the bad news is that participation remains low, and some of their data was pointing to the low rates of physicians and healthcare providers actually talking to patients about research participation. What do you take away from all this? You live and breathe this space.
Yeah, so I was also happy to see that minority participation wasn't down in the dumps, right? That is good to see. In terms of sort of how patients like to hear from it, and if their physician and the physicians don't, whenever I go to see my physician or specialist, I'll ask, like, do you do research? And frankly, a lot of them don't even sort of know about it. It seems to be a two-edged sword, though. So for me, the jury's still out, right? So on the one hand, is it just a communication problem? Meaning, are we not getting the word out in a friendly way that is easily digestible and recallable by a physician? That's the one could be root cause. The other root cause could be, even if we did give them the information, would they be so willing to refer a patient away from themselves? And I don't know. I think where it might make really good sense is if there's a natural referring pattern happening between a GP and a specialist, then certainly, and that specialist happens to be a researcher also, then there's a natural behavior there that you just need to sort of juice a little bit versus it just being, oh, here's a research clinic in your zip code and here's the, 300 physicians that, are in that area too. I think it's a little presumptuous to say that, just by informing them, you generate, better communication with their patient pool. So, having said that, it's been unusual to see a referral program work even when there is good natural referring patterns. And again, that's a whole different set of root causes, whether it's, the operability, the reimbursement, so on and so forth. It's definitely an enigma, I think. At the end of the day, though, from an N of one, I rarely find a physician who's up to speed on all of the clinical research. Sounds like they have plenty to do to keep them busy during the day.
a lot of folks have heard me say that Mrs. Lipset back at home for me is also Dr. Lipset, a family physician who has never referred a single patient into a clinical trial, despite hearing me lament patient recruitment and participation rates for God knows how many years. But I have to say, she no longer seems quite as hostile to the idea. Maybe I've worn her down. But she's now at a place of saying, honestly, I wouldn't even know how to if I wanted to. Do you want me to log in to clinicaltrials.gov, start finding phone numbers, calling up these hotlines and investigator sites, trying to get the patient in. When am I supposed to be doing that? Or am I handing the patient a phone number that I don't even know what's on the other end and sending them off? So it's a great point about, you know, an opportunity here of helping those treating physicians to make the connection.
Right. I mean, clearly a lot of patient recruitment happens through sort of general outreach, and the internet has shown to be a really positive, you know, high volume way to reach patients. And, you know, as it relates to sort of minority participation, you know, lots of minorities are getting on the internet through their mobile phones, smartphones, so as well as emerging regions. So I see a confluence of interesting things happening, not just from the research perspective, but patients are doing this for their own healthcare too, right? They're not leapfrogging, but maybe circumventing or augmenting their care with other empowered patients. And I don't think this is going to reverse itself, clearly.
Patients trust other patients, right? Hey, something else in my that's been in my email inbox, and also I've gotten a kick out of reading in places like Wired and Popular Science. Everyone seems buzzing around Google Glass, and for those that were able to attend the DIA annual meeting last June in Boston, one of the keynote speakers, Dan Kraft from FutureMed, was wearing a pair. In fact, he let me try it on, which is actually pretty cool. I got to really geek out with a loaner pair of Google glasses on. But now we're starting to hear some buzz and interest around healthcare applications for Google Glass. There's a new incubator out there called Glassomics that's meant to stimulate startups around applying Google Glass in healthcare. So it's left me wondering, what are going to be the opportunities for Google Glass or other types of wearable tech for clinical trials in the future? What can you see? Where do you see some of us wearing some of this tech in the future?
Yeah, I've been following Google Glass for a while too, and I think it's aside from the awkwardness of the device itself, and for everyday use, I think it's eminently has some benefits for in a professional setting. So what jumps to my mind immediately is centralized rating or centralized assessments of patients, whether it be for like a dermatology study or the HAM-D or, you know, some sort of gait functionality for MS or whatnot. There's lots of great ways to normalize this stuff and have it be assessed in a standard way with each without having to eliminate the clinician who's there on site, or even be able to have a patient wear something. And if you create the right reference point, so let's say you're doing a gait measurement, if you somehow can create the right reference point, and they can walk, and the glass can figure out how off or on the gait is, or something like that. So there's lots of ways to keep it real, so to speak, but then allow things to be centralized without it being, you know, recording something and sending in a tape or that sort of thing. And then coaching something in real time. So let's say it's a HAM-D interviewer who's doing the interview, has the glasses on, but, you know, can also project that the recording back to the central location. You know, have some coaching happening where you can say, well, how about asking this question or that sort of question? You know, having put very little thought into it, this is the stuff that comes or just jumps off the page at me with regard to its use to clinical research.
It's going to be a remarkable future. You know, I used to think, at first I would think a lot about cool applications at the bench, in the lab, or in our manufacturing floors, whether it was folks being able to access safety data sheets on the fly or other types of documentation. But you're right, whether it's a patient and new types of activities of daily living that we're able to capture together, or, you know, remarkable new ways for investigators to capture data with that patient during a patient encounter. I think that some of this wearable tech will probably look a little less geeky and could actually be pretty remarkable. I'm excited now. I'm going to take a pause for a moment. We're going to introduce the next passenger on this journey. I first met Hugo Stevenson at an e-patient conference in Philadelphia a few years ago. At that time, he was still the mastermind behind iGuard and later MediGuard at Quintiles. But nowadays you find Hugo behind a number of clever young startups where pharma are collaborating on sharing investigator data and other interesting new approaches. So welcome, Hugo, to the show.
Hi there, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you for waking up early in Australia to join us.
So, no, you're very welcome. Certainly a very interesting discussion. I was listening to Joe just before and talking about Google Glass. I mean, certainly one of the things which I see at the moment is what I'd call passive collection of information in the clinical trial space. I mean, for so long, our industry has been built around surveys that we sort of deliver to people, and we ask them, how many times do you wake up a night, and, you know, how far did you walk yesterday, and so on. And, you know, for the first time, really, we're actually able to collect this information passively from the patient. And I think that's going to transform the amount of data that we're able to collect and challenge the way we investigate this information. I mean, you know, interestingly, you know, there's one study that I've been involved with recently where, ironically, they're using a mobile phone to track walking and as an assessment of mobility. But they're actually having to go back and validate this against the previous rating scales that have been used to evaluate mobility. And so it's going to create challenges like that. Certainly a very interesting time.
Absolutely is. You know, I've been a fan of the work. Sandy Pentland at the MIT Media Lab has published some great work on really the range of amazing things that we can capture with that piece of technology in everyone's pocket today, carrying that smartphone around. At least, you know, in these parts of the world, the penetration rate of a smartphone is remarkable. And this thing passively knows so much about me that, you know, it's not a matter of me exposing my personal data, even though I'm sure the NSA is enjoying this radio conversation right now, and it'll all be, you know, part of some secret file on all of us at a future date. But, you know, the notion that there's a fingerprint, there's a pattern of my life that my phone knows, and that perhaps changes in that pattern over time are clinically meaningful. Changes in how I'm socializing or traveling or using a GPS or an accelerometer on that device.
Extremely so. And I think kind of along exactly that line, Craig, is collaboration amongst pharma partners. I mean, in the past, you know, 5-6 years ago even, you know, industry always felt it was the need to sort of solve a problem itself and turn that into a competitive advantage. And ironically, as we're seeing technology advance so dramatically, I think companies are coming together and recognizing that actually solving some of these things collectively and encouraging standardization is actually becoming more of a competitive advantage than trying to solve these things, you know, in a silo. You know, we obviously see that with the challenge with investigators. We see it in challenges with patient recruitment. And I think we'll see it with mobile as well, companies that are actually working together to address these challenges will actually have a competitive advantage over those that try to, you know, go down these paths totally in an isolated way.
Now Hugo, when we met, you had a community of over 2 million patients who had opted in the iGuard or MediGuard platform. They had opted in to stay informed through Quintiles, to understand about safety information about the medicines they were taking. But people don't just show up at the world's largest CRO and start innovating away with crazy new community ideas. What was your road? What led you to that stop in your path?
So, well, you know, this all began at the time where people were looking at personalized health records. And, you know, one of the things that we saw was when you go up to a patient in the street and you say, are you interested in patient, you know, personalized health record? Most patients turn around and go, I have no idea what that is, let alone, you know, whether I want to participate. But we started off really more with you know, the new car registry, and when you buy a new vehicle, you get asked, you know, do you want to get safety alerts, you know, on your vehicle? And, you know, many of us, you know, get letters in the mail when there's a recall or there's an issue. And we tested that message with patients and said, look, are you interested in getting safety alerts and recalls on your medicines? We found 7 out of 10 patients said, yeah, absolutely, I want to get this. And then you turn around and say, are you able to provide me with information about the medicines that you're taking? And because you provided them with a reason up front, 7 out of 10 patients start, you know, rattling off the list of medicines that they're taking. And so we took that approach and basically said, look, anywhere where there was large numbers of people, you know, from, you know, standing outside the, you know, Penn Station in New York City, or, you know, on a website where people are checking their credit ratings and basically say, look, are you interested in getting safety alerts and recalls? Patients would go, yes. So we've got 7 out of 10, you know, engagement there. Then you turn around and say, okay, do you mind telling us what medicines you're actually taking? And 7 out of 10 patients kind of go down that next line. And then you say, you know, obviously as part of this, you're interested in hearing about research opportunities that may be of interest to you. And, you know, most patients that have been walked through that pathway turn around and say, yeah. So we found, I mean, literally even standing outside a sporting stadium, we did many, many, many different kind of activities, throwing spaghetti against the wall. Anywhere with large numbers of patients or large numbers of people, engaging them with that message actually, you know, engaged large numbers very quickly.
That's awesome. That's great. So you really are filling the gap for the patients, and at the same time had a great new opportunity for engagement. So for you today, what's motivating you? What are you looking for in new opportunities for the next step for Hugo?
Well, I mean, I think for me, the biggest single challenge that we're facing, you know, in, from a research perspective, is increased specialty knowledge of how drugs are working and how to target them. So, you know, the next antihypertensive is not going to be a drug that everybody with a high systolic blood pressure takes. You know, it's going to be targeted at particular individuals because we understand more about, you know, how the physiology works and understand, you know, particular challenges that an individual patient has got. The problem with that is as I start treating, you know, particular autoimmune diseases or, you know, even depression, you know, where there's a particular subset that I'm going after, the model of being able to, you know, spend $800 million or $1 billion on developing a drug just doesn't create a business model, you know, when you're starting to deal with more and more targeted markets. So, you know, I think the challenge that we all have to face when we're looking at innovation, and this is one that we have to embrace the regulator in this discussion as well, FDA, and many people have read the final guidance that has come out with recently about risk-based monitoring. The key is how do we actually produce a model for drug development, you know, that allows me to develop a really simple drug or a very targeted drug for, you know, $10 million, $20 million, maybe even $50 million, but to unlock the potential that's sitting in so many companies today. And, you know, that's I think, you know, very exciting for me. And at the same point in time, it's a responsibility that we have as an industry.
Joe, I hear some, you know, a little bit of connection to some of where you're looking to go in terms of thinking about clever ways to get the wisdom of the crowd or other insights into your early development programs.
Yeah, definitely. And with the because patients are hyper-connected and looking to connect, I think it's eminently more doable now than it was before. To Hugo's point, I think the key thing we have to remember is to add value to the patients first. You're never going to get anything back from patients unless you're giving something first. And, you know, lots of industries are in that position to do that. And the smart ones do it so that they can reciprocity later.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Joe, even back to that one, same goes for investigators. We heard sort of the story of Dr. Lipset, you know, being busy, you know, managing her own patients on a daily basis. You know, there's engagement by doctors out there to be interested in research. but they're not going to change from their day-to-day workflow to try something completely different. The key for a lot of research is how do we make research fit the way people live, whether that's the way doctors practice medicine or the way that patients go about their lives. And, you know, not about expecting them to fit the way that we've traditionally like to do research. And ironically, when you turn around and say there's a billion contacts between patients and doctors, you know, every year in the United States, you kind of look at it and go, there is so much potential if only we adapted to fit the way that people lived rather than, you know, expecting, you know, everybody to conform with the way that, you know, industry and regulators have dictated it gets done.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. To build upon that, I think we need to start seeing everyone as our customer. I think there's a general philosophy to do that, but we really need to own that. And by customer, if we talk about the investigators as customers, you know, Amazon does a great job at sort of curating the customer experience. They don't ask you to do things that you've done before. They actually offer up things that at the right time that may be of interest to you. And if we can use that same philosophy with our investigators, you know, we'd be in a much better place, right? So take away all the administrative burden for identity management and that sort of thing. Serve up new opportunities that make sense for them, both from a content and timing perspective. You know, just mirror the stuff that's already been done.
And I mean, you know, good example to that one, Joe. I mean, you know, what we're doing with investigators at the moment and what we've seen, you know, within drug dev is primarily people that are investigators, they're interested in getting research opportunities. So step one is, you know, how you just give them more research opportunities to those that are interested. But the second step, which is critical, is learning quickly the way that Facebook does, the way that Google does, the way that Amazon does, what people are interested in, and then narrowing down what you want to give them. So people aren't really interested in a newsletter every week about every single research opportunity that's going on in the world. They're interested in learning, you know, about MS studies, you know, because that's what they do. And if you don't have an MS study for them, don't bother them. And exactly as you say, Joe, this is stuff that's been, you know, going on for the last 10 years and evolving in, you know, the world of search and shopping and so on. It just behooves us to take some of that learning and just apply it into a clinical trial space.
That's right.
So Hugo, you're becoming the Amazon of investigators then? I mean, it seems like you're swimming in data about investigators today.
Well, and I think there's a lot that we can learn from that. I mean, I always found it amazing, you know, when I came into the pharmaceutical industry, and I think many of us entered clinical research somewhat by accident. You know, as a doctor, I certainly, you know, didn't initially think of this industry, and I, you know, it was only as I kind of got involved in clinical trials, you know, purely by chance that I started to see, you know, its utility and my enjoyment from it. But you know, one of the challenges is if someone does a $30 million study, or, you know, today it's not unusual, $100 million study, with very, very little sort of market research out there. We go out, we go back to the same investigators that we've always used. We often, you know, go back to investigators that have not delivered on studies previously, or have shown that this particular therapeutic area is not their area of interest. I think being able to start pooling that information and learning longitudinally is going to change the way we conduct research. I mean, you look at the banking industry and you know, the way you go about getting a loan today, the banking industry has been able to reduce the cost of giving people loans and managing those loans by, you know, using a whole lot of different risk-based approaches. And part of that is your previous credit history, and part of it is the way that you, you know, service the loan that you're given. And I think, you know, certainly over the next really 2 to 3 years, the way we're going to be selecting investigators in the way will be based on, you know, a pooled track record for that investigator, where some of that pooling will be, you know, based on pooled intelligence from different pharma companies. Some of it will be what we've learned longitudinally about that investigator. So every time I write to them about a depression study, you know, it takes them, you know, 3 or 4 days to respond, you know, with interest. But when I write to them, you know, about a, you know, a refractory, you know, schizophrenia study, they jump on it really quickly, or a study with a particular, you know, antibody, they jump on it really quickly. We start learning what their areas of interest are. We map those two things together. And then you turn around and say, you know, now we start being able to monitor the way that, you know, an investigator is collecting data in a specific study, sort of akin to servicing a loan. You know, and very, very quickly, you know, we start rewarding sites that are engaged. We start being able to work collectively as an industry to bring more investigators on board, you know, of the hundreds of thousands of doctors that are out there that could be involved in research. We bring some of them on board. And, you know, we change the way that the sites get selected. And I think that's actually going to happen very rapidly now. There's a lot of collaboration going on in the industry, and I think this will be, I think, you know, what we would consider to be the future will start becoming reality within the next year or two.
Well, there's some, you know, unprecedented levers that, you know, are enablers that just didn't exist, you know, a couple of years ago, the types of collaboration, the types of analytics and tools that are available today. Well, that's great.
And then, I was going to say, Craig, you overlay the patient on top of that, and, you know, you've changed the way we do research.
Hey, Hugo, I put out a question to Joe. I enjoyed. We talked a little bit about the news. What's the first thing you read every morning? How do you stay current with all these amazing trends and opportunities?
Well, you know, the parallels between what I do and Joe are really strong, and I think, you know, from certainly what I see on the train, and you know, a lot of other people do the same thing too. You know, I check Twitter, I check LinkedIn, I check my email. You know, there's a few different news sites that I flick to, but the one thing which is common amongst all of it is that I actually use my phone to do it. So, you know, I'm probably one of these guilty people that gets up and, you know, as I sit on the edge of the bed, you know, I turn on my phone. And, you know, whether it's the Twitter app or the LinkedIn app or you know, or just my email, you know, I'm connecting probably within 5 minutes of waking up through my mobile phone. And I do that throughout the day, you know, versus my actual desk or my laptop, which is a computer that I'll use to compose, you know, a document or so on. It's the mobile phone that I'm interacting with constantly.
Wow, this has been a great first flight together. And Joe and Hugo, I'm looking forward to seeing you both next month in Boston at the DPharm event, September 19th, 20th at the Fairmont. Between now and then, Joe, if folks wanted to stay connected with you, you're a Twitter man, right? Do you want to put out a Twitter handle?
Sure. My Twitter handle is JOPEKIM, Joe P. Kim. You can find me on LinkedIn. My contact information is readily available, too. And I connect with lots of folks readily and easily. I think there's always more to learn, and I'm excited to stay connected.
And, Hugo, you're social. You're accessible if folks wanted to connect.
I am, absolutely. LinkedIn is probably the best way to connect with me. You know, I use Twitter, but I tend to be following what other people are saying. LinkedIn is the best way to connect with me.
Fantastic. Well, I will look forward to seeing you in a few weeks at the DPharm meeting. And with that, I'd like to just thank Val and the production team. Thank our fantastic first guests, Joe Kim and Hugo Stevenson. I'd also like to put out a big thanks to the sponsor of the first show, Inventive Health. And thank you for listening, for flying with us today. Keep moving forward. Thanks.
Thanks, Craig.
Cheers, Craig.